When I was reading this one interesting example, I asked that what is the longest standing project. That's Rome Aqueduct. Gravity based, it's not technologically something which can overcome. It's serves the need of people drinking water. And it's been made with local material, which tested the time of climate change and everything, right? So that's a very interesting example. And it was done almost 2,000 years back.
Designing is something which always sort of evolves as a project goes along.
Yeah.
That's not good. If we look at more developed countries, you know, the designs are frozen. Before the project, you break ground on the project. Here, design is evolving, and not only is it evolving, it's changing as the construction is happening. That is a sure shot recipe for disaster.
I think it's really about, you know, the consistent delivery of material, design, execution. That could be the only playbook, you know, that a consumer can trust. Is rarely ever seen once the project is complete. And yet, decisions around steel are very often made under pressure, whether it's pressure on account of cost, on timelines, execution, and so on. So the question then always falls to not what is being built, but whether what is being built can be trusted to hold across a period of time. And trust, now we'll come to trust. Important across sectors, but certainly in industries like steel and construction, this is not something that just magically appears just at that point of sale, right? It's something that's earned over a period of time across disciplines. In fact, it's earned with consistency, discipline, and performance under whatever pressure may come your way. Now, this is the podcast. By the way, welcome to the Steel of India podcast. We call this episode Stamped in Steel, where we're going to explore that element of trust, that very, very critical part of the story in infrastructure that is earned across, by the way, capital decisions, material integrity, and certainly performance. It is also something that is a mark of industrial credibility. And that's what we are going to explore on this fifth episode of our season. Welcome to the show. I'm Sheetal, but it's not just me. Thankfully, I'm always, always joined by people who bring their expertise, their wisdom into the conversation. We are going to be joined by Kuwar Vijayan Singh. He is the managing director of Alvarez & Marsal. It's a global professional services firm, and it focuses on areas such as turnaround management, performance improvement, and certainly corporate restructuring. And prior to his role over here in this organization, Kuwar has spent time with McKinsey & Company, where he was a partner almost over 18 years, where he also headed the practices that were materials and advanced analytics in metals. He's also been part of IBM and Cognizant, and he's also an alumnus of IIT Delhi and IIM Kolkata. So that's the wealth of wisdom that he's going to bring to the table. And we are also joined by Shobhit Uppal. Shobhit is Deputy Managing Director of Ahluwalia Contractors, which is a leading EPC company in the country. And he's also someone who's been a past president of the Indian Buildings Congress. And on a separate note, I'm very curious to know what kind of conversations you have in this sort of a congress, but that's another podcast, Shobhit. He's also, his academic achievements include his time at NIT Kurukshetra. He has over 3 decades of experience, and he's been named by ET Now as one of the most influential voices that we have in the industry today. So really grateful that you could be part of the conversation today. And of course, we need our Jindal perspective, Jindal Steel perspective. And we do have Rupali Mehra, who's Vice President Marketing, joining us from Jindal Steel on this conversation. Now, Rupali has also spent in other roles outside of this organization in energy and civil engineering in companies such as British Gas and Skanska. But that's not all to her, personality and professional achievements. Outside of the corporate sector, she's also been associated with bodies such as the United Nations, the UNDP, and the World Economic Forum, where she has served as a panelist, a speaker, and even a trainer in the area of assessment of sustainable development goals. And that's a really important area. Her academic achievements include institutions, hallowed institutions such as the London School of Economics, Rollins College, and more. She's also the founder of Transform Foundation. They do a lot of work in the area of workplace intelligence solutions, and also the governing council member of the Global Cybersecurity Association. As you can see, all endeavors that underline her contributions to the very interesting intersection of public policy, of education systems, and digital transformation. We mean business when we put panels together, and that's just what we have today over here. Thank you once again to all of you for joining us on this podcast.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Yeah. Thank you. And Kumar, I'm going to start with you, right? When you evaluate a project, an infrastructure project, what determines whether it's going to stand the test of time?
Yeah, I mean, a good question to start with. So infrastructure projects usually are planned for 30 to 50 years, right? So there are three, maybe four factors which kind of, if you just in hindsight look at infrastructure projects which have basically been there for some millennia, I've given them an example also. First is always an economic factor. So economic takes care of the NPV, takes care of the economic value that project brings in. Second interesting thing, which is becoming more and more important, is environment. And I'll cover that a little bit.
Right.
Third part is technology. And the fourth part, which again, over the last, I think so, a few decades has become important, is social. Mm-hmm. So on the economics, we always talk about CapEx. But it's not only about CapEx, but it's also about OPEX. So usually CapEx is not a significant part of infrastructure projects. It's about the life cycle of 30, 50 years. What is the operations cost and everything? Second, when you plan infrastructure project, it is supposed to generate some economic value, be it simple road, be it airports, be it ports, whatever you're thinking about. So when the planning is done, what is the economic value is going to generate? Usually you should have very honest assumptions. If you're not doing that, then of course that becomes in 8-10 years, you are starting to realize it's not generating the economic value. That's the economics part of it. Environment, why? Because we are seeing quote unquote black swan events not being black swan. They are not in once in a century. They're happening more and more.
Right.
So you may have problem of climate change. You may have problems of sea erosion if anything is near the port. So all of that you have to now kind of build in. You have to use the right kind of material. You have to kind of do that. So that's the environment part. The third part is technology. So if, very simple example, if you are making a road, it should be modular so that you can add different technologies coming in. You have to have lines for electrical lines, maybe for the optical fiber cables or something, right? It has to be modular. Now, social is an interesting one. It should also meet the community's requirement. Now, when I was reading this, one interesting example, I asked that what is the longest standing project? That's Rome Aqueduct. Gravity-based, it's not technologically something which can overcome. It serves the need of people drinking water. And it's been made with local material, which tested the time of climate change and everything, right? So that's a very interesting example. And it was done almost 2,000 years back, right? So of course, we still only look at 30 to 50 years still. We don't look at beyond that. But there are some examples which tested the kind of time and have been around.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm glad that you brought up something like the Rome Aqueduct as an example, because here's where, on this podcast, we're talking about trust and confidence getting built into infrastructure. And what better examples than some of those iconic ones? We always say, oh, those were the days, Alcyon days of when things were constructed and who were those great people. So that element of trust and confidence is absolutely, is blind, in that we never question structures of the past in many ways. But I also want to ask you, right, you've seen, I'm sure, a number of projects that don't, meet success. Let me just say fail,
yeah.
Right? What's a more common reason for that to happen, Kumar? Is it because they are underfunded, or is it because they are underconceived or under thought through?
It's usually the latter, under thought, underconceived. And the reason is simple. If you look at the capital flows, if a project is good, usually the fund or capital does flow towards good project. If the project is not properly thought of or it's not doing, then the funds also dry because it's, I move to the first part, right? Economic value.
Right.
If 7-8 years down the line, some project is not giving the economic value, the funds will dry up. So it's usually that. And underthought also comes on the technology part, how it's being planned, what technology, what materials you are using, will it basically survive the different shocks down the line, right? So so you're not planning for the launch, basically. We call it ribbon cutting.
Right.
You're planning 10, 15 years of its usability and 30 years of its surviving.
Right.
So if it's not properly thought through, not properly conceived, not properly planned, then that's what usually leads to this.
Anything that you would add, Shobhit, from your observation?
Yes, actually, you know, he's bang on when he says that, you know, a lot of projects, when they're put up to the authorities for approval, you know, they're not budgeted properly. And that is a problem which we face during the construction phase of the project, right? Typically, a project is, the life cycle ranges from about 2 years to about three and a half years. Project ribbon is cut, as Kumar said. You know, the first phase of the life cycle, that is about a year, year and a half, the project runs on its own steam.
Right.
Then after that, you know, if it's not been planned properly, visualization has always been a problem in our country. You know, when projects are announced, projects are becoming more and more complex now. Right. And when you come to the second phase of the life cycle of the project, money crunch starts happening.
Right.
Right? The developers or the owners or the government department, so to say, start inquiring that why are we going over budget? And that is when, you know, people start pulling back, right? There is a reason why in this country there has been only a One Larsen and Toubro. A lot of other companies aspired to get there, but couldn't. It's all about lack of planning, lack of visualization and lack of planning.
Right.
So that is extremely important because projects are now becoming more and more complex. Planning plays a key part.
Key part, if not perhaps the most important
exactly.
part.
Yeah, yeah.
Anything from your experiences having actually, you know, associated with bodies like the UNDP, for example, that really interests me because, again, a lot of thinking, think tank kind of material is available there. What would you add to what they've just said?
See, the points were wonderful, of course, and I'm sure they're more relevant because particularly Shobhit, you know, he's literally looking at these projects day in and day out, you know, come to life. And, you know, Kumar as well has experience of, you know, seeing them from up close. When I look at it from either a UNDP, which is more like a policy angle, or from even as a producer, I see whole lot of change in, you know, how we look at this entire concept of civil engineering, not just from a cost perspective, but from a perspective of human lives.
Right.
Commercially viable, you know, cost overruns, time overruns, you know, all of these terms are far more, you know, business-like.
Yeah.
But if you were to really look at the softer part of this, we're talking to, you know, a builder or a contractor to construct homes, right? We know whatever happened in, you know, Gurgaon property or to some flyovers in the country. People lost their lives, you know. Cost could be a parameter, but I think personally from a overall macro view, it's a matter of responsibility.
Yes.
Whatever we build must be built with a lot of integrity.
Right.
You used this word, you know, when you were, I guess, you know,
posing
this question and, you know, setting this conversation. There's integrity that we normally associate with human character,
mm-hmm.
right? But I think integrity comes in many ways when it comes to integrity of materials,
mm-hmm.
right? And integrity of material does not come just with specifications,
right?
BIS. It comes with the governance.
Yeah.
It comes with that idea that a company will make that consistently high quality of material,
right?
Even when the cost is a burden.
Yeah.
Even when the profits are low.
Right.
You know, that's integrity of material.
Right.
we don't compromise on the integrity of material, because that integrity of material will lead to somebody's loss of life.
Yeah.
You know, then we look at integrity of design. And, you know, you'll agree, Shobhit, and I'm sure you guys would as well. No engineer under design.
Yeah.
No matter what the cost constraint is, no engineer. They never would like to under design. They would always want to design with the best material, mm-hmm. with an idea that the structure should stand at least for a century, you know, and be safe, should be earthquake resistant, you know, should be agile. But whatever happens later, you know, when people tell you to make it quickly or, you know, look at the budget, you know, an engineer's dream of making something safe comes down crashing. So there's a design integrity. We must honor that.
Right.
Right. So material integrity is, of course, important. Design integrity is also equally important.
Right.
And then comes, of course, the third part, which is the execution integrity.
Yes.
You know, I guess whatever happened in these projects, maybe the material was right. Maybe the design was right. Maybe we faltered at the time of execution.
Yeah.
Why so? You know, so unless it all works in a system.
Right.
You know, it's not about one failing or the other. It's about all three of them
coming together.
And that's when a structure can stand for 100 years.
Yeah. Thank you for tying that all in, because I think you've summarized the underthoughtness and how that, you know, comes into play when it comes to projects that don't meet.
That's the reality. Yeah.
Adding to Rupali's point, you know, buildings are now designed for 100 years. You know, we're working on the Central Vista project, where all buildings which are being constructed, be it the central secretariats, be it the parliament, you know, they're designed for 100 years.
Right.
So specifications is one thing.
Right.
Materials. Now, you know, in this country, you also have materials which are off the grid. Say, for instance, steel. It's a structural steel building that we're doing 3.5 million square feet. The steel is 450 grade. In the days gone by, you know, we were working with 255, 300 at the most, 310. Now, 450 grade. In fact, you know, the structural steel manufacturers, they've set up assembly lines to cater to buildings which are designed for 100 years.
Right.
But the key here is the next part, the skill levels, right? Upskilling is something that all of us need to focus on also.
Right.
Traditionally, construction industry has been a labor-based industry. While we are mechanizing now, you see cranes dotting the skyline, be it in Gurgaon, be it in the heart of Delhi, but we are still labor dependent.
Right.
Right. And that is because of lack of standardization. Upskilling has to come in now. It's not only the construction entities or companies which have to do this.
Right.
It's also the manufacturers, it's also the government, which needs to come in and needs to ensure that the high quality materials which are being brought to site, or the high end cranes or machineries which are being brought to site,
right. We
also have operators or workers to handle them properly on site.
Right.
That is something where, you know, holistic planning comes into the picture. That is where we've been lacking till now. So that is what I think we need to come together, the entire ecosystem, be it of the government, be it of developers, be it of manufacturers, or be it of the construction entities. They need to come together and see how to address this challenge.
Yeah. You know, in many ways, from what I've heard all three of you say until now, you've already told us what are the factors that influence the success or the failure of a particular project. And yet, what I noticed, Shobhit, is that perhaps things can actually look pretty viable at the project planning stage, right? Everything seems kosher. You've checked all the right boxes. And yet, on ground, there is a divergence from that planning reality that is set off in motion, right? What are the reasons for this divergence? Where do you see it happen at first glance?
So one is visualizing the risks, mitigating those risks. That is something which we've started doing now. And when I say we, I mean the entire ecosystem. That is something traditionally which has never been done.
Right.
Right. So that's important. Secondly, we've already talked about planning. That is, so risk mitigation has to be built in into the planning.
Okay.
And then, you know, when we start a project, or again using the phrase that Kunwa used, ribbon cutting, designing is something which always sort of evolves as a project goes along.
Yeah.
That's not good. If we look at more developed countries, you know, the designs are frozen. Before the project, you know, you break ground on the project. Here, design is evolving, and not only is it evolving, it's changing as the construction is happening. That is a sure shot recipe for disaster. Secondly, you know, when we talk about, you know, skill levels being low, people generally feel it's with the construction entity that, you know, the workers are not properly skilled.
Right.
We are facing or seeing that problem with designers also.
Right.
You know, buildings are becoming more and more complex. Rupali mentioned timelines. Timelines are getting squeezed,
right?
Now, for instance, the 3.5 million square feet building, we have to construct and finish, design, construct and hand over in 2 years flat.
Right.
Now, these are aggressive timelines, which are at par with what's happening in the developed nations.
Right.
But the skill levels are falling short even at the designing stage.
Right.
So designing a project is extremely important, and freezing the design before you break ground is extremely important.
So just to underline a couple of interesting examples. So China, the largest infrastructure built in the human history over the last maybe 4 or 5 decades. Standardization, prefab, making offsite, then bringing it up, right? So they have covered the entire country doing that. So that helped. By design, infrastructure projects, you have to bring a humongous number of people right now in the Indian context to the site. Once the site is done, then they move to some other project. Mm-hmm. And they usually don't move project to project. Like, you have to just literally collect different skill sets and then kind of disperse and doing that.
Yeah.
There's some initiatives taken by the government. They're trying, for example, to figure out, have a quote-unquote registry of the national skill mission and labor, different skill sets and everything. But it'll take time. It's happening, but it won't solve the problem as we are saying. It's a remote location and doing that.
Not even made a dent. Sorry.
I know. I was putting it mildly, but yeah. But yeah. But that has to be done. But the standardization and doing the prefab is one way to go. But there are other things. On the just coming back to the question you asked, the failure happened during design, unfortunately, but it realized sometimes much later. When you start doing the postmortem analysis, then you realize that the design was a flaw, the material was a flaw, something was a flaw, unfortunately. But yeah, it happens during the conceptualization. We call it DPR phase. That is where the problem happened. But
it plays up later. Yeah, so you brought up that question. You know, I wanted to check, because failure is often viewed, somehow we sense it as an outcome, a function of outcome. We leave it and everything is over. Oh my God, it's failed. But clearly, I mean, is this true? Is that only visible to people at the end of a particular project? Or is there a way to tell that it's been embedded in some system somewhere or across systems much, much earlier on? What are the examples that you've seen? Or this is like, I want to give people a playbook. Look for these things. If you've not got this right, you are set for failure. That's what we're trying to say here.
So it's about processes. It's about SOPs at every stage of a project, be it in design, be it while selecting materials, which is a part of design, categories of project, even on the public sector side, where you would feel that there are certain clients who do their due diligence properly. There are proper peer reviews, maybe multiple levels of peer reviews. So you talked about playbook, what the consumer needs to see. The consumer goes by the pedigree, and the pedigree is reflected in the kind of projects that are delivered. If I was to take a name, from the vendor, she already talked about Jindal. The pedigree is there. That's why they are sort of qualified or pre-qualified to supply material to large and more visible projects. You look at the DLFs of this world. You know, that's why they command the kind of pricing that they do.
Right.
So it's about setting processes. So in our ecosystem, if there are 3 or 4 constituents of the ecosystem, each constituent needs to have well-defined SOPs.
Right.
And those need to be followed. And That's where the end product is literally a byproduct. If the processes have been followed, diligently, the byproduct is good.
Yeah. So what you're saying, right? I want to put that in the context of material selection or the choice of materials. One would imagine that is a function of specifications. But then one wonders if it is also sometimes an active decision born out of exactly what you said, pedigree, branding, brand influence, and so on. How would you explain that choice to us from a materials perspective?
So as Kovar mentioned, when a project is visualized or conceived, there is a DPR which is prepared. And when that's taken to the next level, when the consultants or designers are brought on board, they are the ones who start specifying, because they design and then they specify the material.
Right.
But now with more and more large contracts becoming EPC, or contractor's role, contractor traditionally used to be on the lowest end of the totem pole, right? He used to stand there, ji azur, jo aap bolo hum kar dete hain. But that's all kind of changed now.
Right.
Right, because the developers or the owners of the projects have also realized that a contractor brings with him a lot of experience, which he can value add to the project. So we also now in EPC contracts, we say no, we want to, to use the word again, pedigreed manufacturers or suppliers. We want to go with them. We our experience with so and so has not been good, be it in the quality or framework, or also from a supply point of view. So that's extremely important, because as I said, buildings are becoming more complex. You go to Gurgaon, traditionally there used to be 10, 12 story structures there. Now every other building is 40, 45, 50 story, which is being made there. So you need to, and they're to be constructed in 2.5 to 3 years,
right?
Compressed timelines. So quality of material and hence quality of suppliers is extremely important.
I think it's really about, the consistent delivery of material design execution. That could be the only playbook, that a consumer can trust.
Brand being influenced, being overstated into a B2B thing is a thing of the past.
No, I think brand is now more consistent with trust. When he says L&T, for example, L&T is not a brand because somebody marketed it. It's a brand because it performed consistently over the years.
Over a period of time.
Yeah. Exactly. And same with Jindal's. We just have Jindal Panther as one of the brands, only for one or, a few of our products.
Yeah.
But just because we have performed consistently and Ahluwalia's have performed consistently, therefore there's a brand.
Adding on to both of them, there are two important points. One is predictability in performance. That's where the brand trust and everything comes up. And the second thing is, which Shobhit, you started alluding, that yes, there should be one overall owner of the quality delivered. You cannot have 15, 16, 20 subcontractors doing that. So that EPC point you were making. Both are very important to the question you asked. Now, first on the predictive, I'll just add a couple of other examples. You have two icons of steel industry, Nippon Steel and POSCO. POSCO has been supplying to Hyundai and Samsung for their shipbuilding for the last 40 years. Same grade, very consistent, and they are dealers when it comes to shipbuilding. Nippon has been the only supplier to Japanese bullet trains, Shinetsu, and they, same. Once the performance and processes were set up, they became the sole suppliers, and they have been doing it for now since 1960.
I just wanted to mention a point too, because this is just close to my heart. You talked about steel companies or material companies will have to kind of step up and, come up with standardization, newer products, innovative products. The world has moved really, really far ahead, in terms of adoption of steel, structural steel per se. So I was just wanting to give that example. 20 years ago, Jindal Steel, at that time we were Jindal Steel and Power. We introduced the concept of universal beams and columns within.
Yes.
And, it was so difficult at that time. I remember, taking an IIT professor, with me to customers and saying, hey, this is a parallel flange beam. You could bolt it. You don't have to meld it. This has higher, ability to take loads. You could do with lesser steel. It's better than those, tapered flange beams and what have you. And then they said, oh, there's no standard. Then we had to work with BIS to get standard out. We did all the testing and then we kind of got the reports out. Then we again proved, you know, had to prove that in some structures. And then it took us about 20 years to today come to a point where somebody like, you know, Shobhit knows that there is universal beam and column in this country made by Jindal's and it's adopted. And today companies like EIL, you know, they're just, you know, using that in high strength, saving a lot of steel, you know, which actually contributes to a lot of sustainability, correct, you know, as well. So it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of ownership. It takes a lot of commitment, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of do something different from how it was being done before. You know, so it's a process, you know, it's as you said, trust, when I say consistency. So it's not just about performance. It's also about looking beyond your current performance and investing in newer level of higher standards, you know, that you could create for yourself and in the industry. So a lot is to be done.
Yeah. So it's coming back to the ecosystem. Kumar mentioned EPC. Now, it's not about whose neck to catch. That's negative. It's about we are now as EPC contractors, be it us, be it Larsen & Toubro or a handful of others, we are masters of our own destiny now.
Yes.
Right? We are, if a project is entrusted to us, then we plan the entire thing from breaking ground to handing over the key to the end user. And we control everything, be it procurement of material from established manufacturers such as Jindal, or turning it into, you know, construction of the building per se, using that material in making the building, and then following due processes to hand over that building commissioned, right? And even in some EPC cases now, you know, especially public sector projects, we are doing operation and maintenance for about 2 to 5 years. So I must mention here, in this country, any paradigm shift, when it happens, it is driven by the government.
Yes.
And because government has the necessary heft.
Right.
To, you know, drive or overcome the inertia. And we've been seeing that. I've been seeing that. The kind of change that has been brought about in the last 12, 14 years is tremendous. Right. And the government, why has private sector manufacturing stepped up? Because the government, post 2014, has said, we only want to govern.
Correct.
We don't want to do business.
Yeah.
And which is the right attitude? You know, we use, as I said, we used to stand in line, go to SAIL or other government manufacturer and say, we need this material. The material used to take 2 to 3 months to come. Now, you know, all these companies, they're supplying in 2 weeks, you know, from indenting to placing the order, the material is there.
Yeah.
Even the higher grades, or grades which are not commonly manufactured. Right. And then all these companies are more accessible. So supply chain, from that point of view, you know, we can get a better control. So EPC has really revolutionized the way construction is done. And I think that's the way forward.
Yeah. Since you've come to a forward-looking thing about infrastructure building, you'll have dotted the conversation with plenty of examples in that regard. I thought I must ask, for the benefit, of course, of our viewers, what is it? We're looking at India at 100 shortly, 2047. And this call for Viksit Bharat, Make in India, is at a crescendo. It's reached a crescendo, right? In that context, what's going to set infrastructure that's merely delivered apart from that which will stand the test of time? I do know you've dealt with this aspects of this answer, you know, throughout your conversation, but let's start with you. What are the differentiators? What will tell the boys away from the men, not to use sexist terminology, but nevertheless?
No, so I think so. See, we're taking the right steps, right? I'll just step back. When China started doing that, if I remember correctly, infrastructure spend used to contribute 16 to 18% of the GDP. Ours is around 7%. So we are still behind and we have a lot to catch up. And you look at any markers, we call it steel intensity. That's a very important marker for the steel industry. We are at around 100 kgs per capita. Global average is more than 200. And these countries developed went to 400, 500. Korea would be at 1,000, right? So I think so. There is, when it comes to steel, not only on infrastructure, but towards the Viksit Bharat,
right,
it becomes a very, very important kind of a, you can call, pillar to make it happen. So when we talk about infrastructure, we usually talk about roads, we talk about ports, we talk about railway networks, and then the railways running on it. You have Vande Bharat and coming up. So you have different looking at it. But if you look at the new tailwinds which is coming, people are talking about data centers. Hugely, hugely steel intensive, hugely structural. We have a target of 6 times of data center capacity in the next 5 years, and we are far behind.
Right.
Right. US is around, I think, 5,000 plus data centers right now. So we are just catching up. Right. So anything you export, be it auto, be it different thing, like even China, steel plays an important role. So if you just dial back, infrastructure lays down the platform for these industries to kind of flourish.
Yeah.
And then we are not only making for India, now we are started thinking about making for the world. Right? So this thinking has come. So when you're thinking it now, not for, as you said, India at 100, 25 years hence, as Viksit Bharat government came in, they came with a very, very aspiration plan of NIP, National Infrastructure Policy, which, you know, everything you're seeing, they're doubling the speed. What you are seeing in the last 10 years, everything is now doubling. Be it 4-lane expressways, 6-lane expressways, be it airports, be it everything, right? And then they are inviting and giving incentives for industries to come and set up shop. And one of the many important materials, but steel will play a major role when it comes to just making sure this happens over next 20 to 25 years.
Yeah.
Right. So this is, I think so.
It brings into a very, thank you so much. I was waiting for somebody to kind of raise this. You see, India as a story, I mean, while infrastructure has a percentage to a GDP, which is small, as you said, steel, you know, goes in the infrastructure and construction sector to the tune of about 65%, you know. So when it comes to the sector, you know, steel adoption really depends on this sector. I mean, we look at a lot of steel around us. We look at utensils. We look at, you know, look at white goods. We look at a lot of automobiles. All of that together, you know, is within about 35%. All right. So 65% goes into construction and infrastructure. You know, interesting number. You know, I was looking at, you know, whatever we have at home is less than 1 or 2% of steel, you know, that we use. What we use is steel. In per capita consumption is primarily the infrastructure and the buildings that we live in, the houses that we live in. And again, interestingly, if you look at the world, in the construction and infrastructure sector, the adoption of structural steel versus the adoption of concrete-based construction,
right,
is very different from what it is in India. So I'm sure Shobhit would be able to comment on that. Today in India, I think for structural steel usage, which is beams and columns made of steel, right? Steel buildings, the lighter buildings, the earthquake-proof buildings, you know, that's just about within 15%. Whereas if you, and 85% of construction is cement. Yeah. If you look at the world, you know, this percentage of structural steel in this sector is upwards of 50%, goes up to as high as 70%. So we really have an upside.
Yeah.
So this is a huge upside.
Yeah.
If you want to really convert these structures, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, one over the other. There's also a way to go, which is composite, right? And I guess, you know, these guys are doing some wonderful job in composite as well. I read about it. But in terms of steel adoption, and even if you look at the world average, you know, currently about, you know, upwards of 200. If you switch, you know, percentage of your concrete-based projects into steel-based projects or composite projects, this will get you the number, right? Right. It's all about awareness. It is smarter. It is lighter. It is earthquake-proof. It is sustainable. You don't have to make steel again and again. The world has done it already. There's a lot of awareness needed. That is the right choice. But, you know, it's a matter of time when this awareness really comes in people.
Yeah.
It's beginning to happen now. It's a very important point she's raised, is that, you know, in the days gone by, time was never a tangible factor. You know, and the conventional wisdom was using structural steel in making buildings. It's costlier.
Yes.
Right? It's 20, 25, 30% costlier. Now what's happened is time has become a tangible factor. There's a cost to time.
Exactly.
Right? So, large projects now. I mentioned the Central Vista project that we are doing.
Right.
What we're doing, another very interesting project where, coincidentally, Jindal is supplying steel. It has 30,000 tons of structural steel. This is for DLF. It's right on the border of Delhi and Gurgaon near Ambience, where we are doing 6.5 million square feet of commercial space, 40 meters in the ground, 5 basements, 18 stories above ground, all steel, all structural steel, right? And the promoters there want the project finished in 2.5 years. And we are on track to do that.
Right.
Right. This can only be done when we use structural steel or composite buildings, because a lot of work is done offsite, as I mentioned earlier. Fabrication is 30,000 tons. In the days gone by, you could not have even imagined, doing those kind of members or concrete members on steel. It would have taken, it would have taken 6 years or 7 years. Now the project will be finished in 2.5 years. So time is the key here.
Yeah. And also, just to get, I'm sure you'll agree, if you look at high-strength steel that Shobhit mentioned earlier, if you move to 690 QL for bridges, if you move to 450 MPA for steel in buildings, it actually is not more expensive because you're using lesser amount of steel for the, for the same amount of strength. Right. It's awareness, right?
Awareness, yes.
Awareness and adoption.
Yeah. It's not just enough to just know.
Yeah.
Got to act on it. Fantastic. I think we've come away with some ideas, and maybe we look at structures quite differently, because one thing that you have learned from today's conversation is that steel is not an attention seeker. It is something that actually holds responsibility. And you've also seen how trust in infrastructure is something that is not, born in a single moment of time or doesn't fall to a single person's choice at that particular moment. It's something that's earned over decisions across systems and across time. So the next time you actually, see a structure that has held and stood the test of time, remember that it is not just the structure that has stood the test of time. It is the trust, it is the confidence, it is the quality, and it certainly is the credibility that a brand has carried along with it across the sands of time. Thank you so much for watching the Steel of India podcast. We have been totally stamped in steel. We'll be back with the next episode. And speaking of brand, it's going to be the season finale of season 2 on narratives that endure. But thank you so much to our guests as well for making this conversation among the best that I really have had. You've been brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.